Just after World War I, a young army officer named Dwight Eisenhower led a military convoy across the United States. The trip took 62 days. By 1955, there was a movement afoot to modernize American roads, and Ike, now president, took the wheel.
A modern highway system is essential to meet the needs of our growing population, our expanding economy, and our national security.
Eisenhower's the one who signed legislation creating the interstate system. The first stretch of highway in that system began in Missouri, but the first section to be completed was in Kansas. It's an 8-mile stretch of I-70 just west of Topeka, heading into the Flint Hills. So now, from this spot where it all began, the 46,000 miles of highway that now comprise the interstate system can get you to just about any major city in the United States in 24 hours. But to build this impressive piece of infrastructure, city blocks were bulldozed, and all along the highway, billboards, fast food chains, and gas stations have since sprung up. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to talk about how Kansas and Missouri have been shaped by I-70. With me now is Charlie Nemers. He's the director of a transportation infrastructure center at Mizzou. Charlie, do I understand correctly that you and the highway go back a ways?
Yes, Gina, we sure do. 50-some years.
Tell me about your history first.
Well, I grew up in a little town in Iowa, went to school at Marquette University in Milwaukee, came out with an engineering degree, went to work for a utility, and moved out to California later on in a couple of years with Douglas Aircraft, and decided that, hey, I wanted to get into beams that were bigger than a foot long, and so I moved to the highway business and joined the Federal Highway Administration. They build the roads in national parks and national forests and work closely with state DOTs on the interstate system. I worked with them for 32 years in 8 different states, so I was involved with building interstates all over the country. I had a real pleasure of working on the Straight Creek Tunnel. It's now called the Eisenhower Tunnel, which was the highest and longest automobile tunnel in the world on I-70 west of Denver. I worked on I-70 in Ohio, where we shut down the interstate to move strip mining shovels across the interstate as a rather unusual piece of activity having to do with the interstates. I then moved into research with the Federal Highways, retired, and came to Mizzou to work in transportation in the College of Civil Engineering. So I've worked really closely with a lot of DOTs. I was the head of the Federal Highway offices in Delaware, Georgia, and also in New Jersey.
So you know the highway.
Well, I'm pretty familiar with it, you betcha.
So how much of the way we live in Kansas and Missouri do you think is traceable to I-70?
I think, well, to the interstates in general, it's huge. To I-70, I think a great deal has changed in that I-70 basically running from Baltimore to Provo, Utah, and Kansas and Missouri are right in the middle of that. And that's the largest freight movement interstate east-west in the United States. So just in terms of amount of freight moving through the system is huge, and I-70 is a corridor for that. But it also brings in a lot more economic activity because when you have good transportation, that attracts businesses and industry. So it's a catalyst for that as well.
Do you think that being sort of the origin spot for the highway system should be a point of pride for Kansas and Missouri?
Oh, I think so. It shows that we're sort of maybe at the leading edge of this. We were really interested in getting it going. I know in my own personal family, we had a situation where we needed to go to Minneapolis for medical purposes, and it used to be a 2-day drive. Now we can go up there in the morning and back at night almost. So it's really expanded the opportunities for everyone. People want to live here in Columbia. They want to go to a Chiefs game. You know, they go over in the morning, they go to the Chiefs game and come home at night. That used to be definitely a night out in between. The same for a lot of those kind of activities.
Talk to me more about the history of I-70 in Kansas and Missouri during the construction phase.
Well, I think that some of the things that were really interesting when we first got started building the interstate was the technology that we were using to build highways was, I'll say, somewhat pedestrian. We were moving kind of slowly on it. But when the interstate came with a major emphasis on huge construction projects, that was an incentive to do a whole lot of things better. And so we came up with new designs for bridges, that the concrete girders that you see on most of the bridges, or many of the bridges on I-70 and so on, were developed at the start of the interstate system because they were an economic type of bridge, as a precast post-tension concrete bridge. That was a big incentive. We came up with different ways to pour concrete, where you have it used to be you dumped out and spread it out. Now you have machines that just don't have forms, and you slip form the concrete. Our asphalt technologies has changed remarkably since we started the interstate, all because we had the opportunity to grow a program that had such large consequences. So I think just the engineering technology was outstanding.
This was the largest public works project in the history of the country. Can you talk to me about being part of that scale of a project?
Well, I tell you what, when I was a young engineer in the late 1960s getting started, it was exciting because we used to get a map every quarter that would show the United States with a little blue mark showing which sections of interstate were starting to be opened. And every, you know, our energies were all directed towards how we can do these things better. And I was working in California on the interstates. I worked on the Interstate 5 connection with Tijuana, where we had more, had all the lanes for the border crossings. And it was just amazing experience there. I worked on the Interstate 10 going into New Orleans, Louisiana, and some of the engineering there was just fantastic. And everything that we were doing around the country, it was the first time we were building new kind of interchanges. And we saw it was just really has been an exciting area because all of us that were involved with the interstate were, I had a small little role to play. Mind of that, but I was part of the program. And it was just something that everybody was excited to be in. It was really fun.
When you talk about places where there were just extraordinary pieces of engineering, is there anything in Kansas and Missouri that you would draw our attention to, especially along I-70?
Well, there's some really interesting things, I think. There's a spot on I-70 west of St. Louis, maybe 50 miles or so. It's called Mineola Hill. And it's if you're just driving on it, it's just a large hill that you have to you go up or down depending on which way you're going. But in the middle of it, there's the median is wide for a spot there, and in the middle of it is a big outcropping of rock, just a rock, and it just doesn't seem to be very significant, but there's a lot of stories around it that it was a rock that was saved when they built the interstate system because it was called slave rock, and they used it as a place where they used to sell slaves, way long time ago, and that was sort of saved as he went through that. And I think that's kind of an interesting thing. There's
the highway had to be built to accommodate the preservation of that piece of history.
Well, I think this was this was before, I'm telling you a little more than I know maybe here, but it was before the environmental movement. And at the time, I think they moved the road around this rock as much for engineering purposes as for saving a culture purposes. I was no part of those decisions, but nonetheless, it came to be significant in that people said, "Hey, well, those rocks that you're saving really had a history that went back some more than that." So it's just kind of an interesting little thing. I think also in western part of Missouri between Kansas City and Columbia, there are several buildings on along the right of way that you can see that were built the red brick with the kind of a stone corners on them that were built for providing support and access to radio towers that at the time were built across the state. And so it was the interstate has several, you can see these buildings, there's maybe four or five of them. And it's another part of culture that of Missouri that went along with it.
Why did they start building the interstate here in the middle of the country. I am not an engineer, and that is definitely a good thing. But my instinct would be to start building something on one end and finish on the other.
Well, I think everybody was trying to build right away, and the money went out to all the states. It wasn't like we were going to build all of I-70, then all of 95 and something like this. The monies went to all the states, and they were to build the programs as they came to it. At the time, the head of the American Association of Transportation Officials, which was like the organization of all the state heads of all the state departments of transportation, they were basically highway departments. At that time, the head of that whole organization was a gentleman from Missouri. And so I believe his name was Whitten. And when he, so at the start of the business, he said, hey, we want to be the first one. So they were, because he was involved with the signing of it and the from his role as being ahead of all the highway departments association, he got his oar in the water first so that he could say, hey, Missouri had the first project that we led after the signing of things. So it was just, it was here, I think, a lot because of the initiative of the head of the highway department in Missouri at the time and the position that he was in.
What do you think, talk to me more about the need for an interstate like I-70. I mean, what was lacking when it came to the way people and goods got around before I-70?
Well, you mentioned Eisenhower and his 60-some days to get from Baltimore to San Francisco. That was a real problem. You couldn't move goods and services, fruit and vegetables, farm products coming from Missouri or coming into Missouri. The areas that could be served was very limited. Maybe you couldn't travel for more than maybe 200 miles a day. Now in the interstate, you can travel, you know, four times that in a day. So it just opened up everything. It made relevant the farm materials from Missouri. It made the the aircraft industry in St. Louis blossomed because they were able to get parts and movements around the country. So really, by opening the interstate up, it really just leveraged our economy tremendously.
Was it pretty clear early on what the route would be for I-70, or do you know of any hand-wringing over the path this thing would take?
Well, this is a very interesting question that you ask, Gina, because the federal government in the interstate system, and really in all the highway programs, the federal law says that it's a state program that's federally funded. And so the decisions on the locations were really left to the states. So the federal government laid out and said, we're going to try to connect St. Louis with Kansas City, but they didn't say where it had to go in that alignment. And that was up to the people in Missouri to identify. Now, the federal government coordinated, and that was my role with the Federal Highway Administration. We coordinated with the states so that made sure that we could get agreement on where the crossings of the interstate would be. So we lined up with Missouri and Kansas, lined up, and Kansas and Colorado lined up, and so on. So it was a collegial working together. But it was really important to note that the decisions were not a federal decision. They were state decisions.
Why is that important to know? I mean,
because the impact on the interstate of really of all transportation really is local. You know, the impact on the people that are land is being used for the interstate, the access to it, the facilities associated with it, all of those are local issues. The federal government's role in the transport in the interstate system was to provide for standards so that we had consistencies in design, so that all the exits from the freeway were basically on the right side, that the lanes that widths were consistent and the shoulder widths were consistent and the technologies for length of service and so on were consistent. So there's a lot of technology leadership that the Federal Highway Administration had, but the decisions on locations was really a local matter. And that really goes back to Andrew Jackson when he became president in the 1830s. He stopped building the first national road because he said at the time it was a local decision. And so the highway program is somewhat unusual in the government scheme of things because it's one where the decision-making is at the local level, but the guidance and the overall technology support comes from the national level.
Can you give an example of a local impact that I-70 had on a community in Kansas or Missouri?
Oh, well, there's so many. I don't know where to start. But if you go to the small little towns that you pass through in Missouri, at every interchange, you'll find restaurants, motels. You'll find warehousing, service stations. So there's all kinds of, let's say, micro businesses that grow as we go through that. Once we get into the more metropolitan areas, you know, access to the airports and the major trucking terminals are huge. We're looking to see how we can make our transportation systems interface with each other. Certainly, all the major airports and river ports or railroad connections connect back into the interstate system. So hopefully we have a smoother transition of flow of people and freight through that. I didn't work in Missouri on the early parts of the interstate here, but I know that when I was in Ohio, Penny's Warehouse wanted to build open a warehouse in the city or in the state. And so we got involved with building a whole interchange that the Penny's Warehouse paid for the interchange because they wanted to have access to the interstate system. And that was not, there's probably a couple of those in the state here too, where the local communities or businesses contributed to the building of the interchange because they wanted the access that you gained from it. Well, now, part of the state's and federal role is to make sure that those interchanges didn't impact negatively on any way towards the flow or safety of the projects.
Well, let's bring Monroe Dodd in on this. He is our history guy here on Central Standard. Hi, Monroe.
Good morning, Gina.
So tell me more about Kansas City specifically, how Kansas City neighborhoods and communities were affected by the construction of I-70.
It is interesting to consider how Kansas City might look if it hadn't been for interstate highways. Down where there's the south part of the freeway loop is a kind of a canyon down there, a ravine over which you pass or through which you go under, and it sort of defines it and the rest of the freeway loop are often said to have caused downtown to become sort of an island. If you look at a picture of 15th Street, which was the name of Truman Road before it became Truman Road, looking north into the city, there's just buildings. There's just standard streets and just buildings. And there is, in essence, a cityscape that is completely connected as opposed to one that feels as if you're looking from one side of the river to the other. This is true on all parts. The north part of the freeway loop was a thing called 6th Street, and it was first developed as the 6th Street Expressway, and the city wanted to widen it and multi-lane it. It became part of the interstate system. And this whole loop, it defines downtown, whereas in the early, as of the middle 1950s, all that was one smooth landscape. Now they were rich and poor and big buildings and little and neighborhoods that were nice and some not so nice in that downtown area. But it was all a smooth transition. To my mind, what the eye sees is important. But also important is the communities that were sliced in two and the homeowners and others who had to move. That was an immediate problem of long ago. The most notable and the longest-lasting example of that is not really an interstate. It's the Bruce Watkins Roadway. It's the most recent to our minds because it took all manner of compromising and took decades to finish. Early on, the interstates, through Kansas City at least, primarily went through poor neighborhoods, a little easier to condemn, a little easier to buy people out. And perhaps some people didn't cherish their homes as much as people in more expensive neighborhoods were. But it is true that if you can drive east on I-70 from downtown now, and you notice, oh, here's some houses on this side, and here's some houses on that side. They're not very far from the street. But if you had to get from one place to another, you would have a massive job of getting around it. Actually, that's the same was true out in rural areas, where at the time the interstates were built, there were some difficulties that farmers foresaw. I used to be able to cross a road and get to the neighbor's house or downtown. Now I've got to go along this frontage road many miles and come back. I'm mentioning mostly cons here, and that is not to say there aren't a heck of a lot of pros about the interstate system that our earlier guest has talked about. But that was the impact on the city, especially Kansas City, Missouri, the slicing through.
In Kansas City, Kansas, Strawberry Hill is an example that comes to mind. I mean, I went a few years ago and talked to some people who were hanging out in a bowling alley, and the old timers there would refer to everything in terms of whether it happened before the highway or after the highway. Can you talk to me? What do you know about neighborhoods like Strawberry Hill and how their history was affected by I-70?
They were very tight neighborhoods, culturally, ethnically. And what the interstate did was basically to slice off part of Strawberry Hill. There's a picture I saw of the 1950s looking across the river valley toward the other side. And you can see houses dotting the side of the hill, going down them and stuff. The highway just basically zoomed through and obliterated all that, leaving sort of a cliff-like thing on the top of Strawberry Hill. That meant a certain diaspora of the neighborhoods. If you were a Croatian growing up in a Croatian neighborhood and at church things were labeled in Croatian or Serbian or whatever, then all of a sudden there's a big chunk of your neighborhood that probably had to move out, had to move somewhere else. And in the days of the interstates, that somewhere else was off in the suburbs. It in effect broke up a neighborhood and created sort of a diaspora, at least at the time.
Tell me more about the birth of suburbs in and around Kansas City and I-70.
You have to think about World War II and what it came after. Through the 1930s, most people who became adults during World War II, during the 40s, had endured this a lot of privation. Now, the privation was not always complete deprivation. It was relative. We can't afford to go to the movies tonight. We can't afford to buy a new car, that kind of thing, all through the Depression. Along comes the war. Car manufacturing shuts down in order to make military vehicles. Gas rationing is in place. Once again, use of cars is not very frequent. After the war, it took the auto manufacturers a couple years, and then they started spewing out cars, tens and thousands of automobiles, and Americans bought them because those were heady days after World War II. Look what we just accomplished for the world. Let's go buy a car, and we've got a car we can get somewhere. And developers saw that as a sign that, hey, we can build houses way out here. We don't have to rebuild downtown. Land around Kansas City especially is very inexpensive. Let's just start a subdivision. And this is still going on today.
Well, we want to hear from you. If you live in a community that's been shaped by I-70, or do you work in an industry that's reliant upon it, give us a call to share your perspective, not just on how we built this highway, but how the highway shaped us. 816-235-2888. And truckers, we know you're listening. We hope you'll give us a call. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today we're talking about Highway 70 in Kansas and Missouri. Kansas opened the first section of the interstate in the nation in 1956, marking the beginning of the biggest public works project in U.S. history. When it was complete in 1970, it was the longest continuous stretch of highway to be completed by any state. In Missouri, this highway connects the state's two biggest cities while also carrying more rural traffic on a daily basis than any other route. Now it's home to a density of billboards that's either impressive or depressing, depending on how you view such things. Monroe Dodd, what about those billboards?
What about the billboards? What about the other complaints about the interstate, that it's dull, we're being assaulted on our senses by all these things? That's all true. But if you could do what I had done, which is, as a child, ridden in the back seat with my parents down a two-lane highway, because that's all there was, U.S. highway, but a two-laner, and get behind a line of trucks. Dad, why can't we go faster? Because there's trucks ahead. I can't pass all four of them at once. Gone through the little towns, town after little town, stopping at a stoplight, stopping for pedestrians, getting going another block, stopping at a stoplight. That was life before that. I can remember once our family vacation took us into Kansas City. And it for at least 4 hours outside of town, we were stopped and slowed down by traffic. And I can remember at the time, I had never heard the word interstate highway as a little kid, and I didn't really know what they meant. But I thought, there's got to be some solution to this. This is awful. And America did not make the solution to reduce our dependence on cars. So it has caused the solution by saying, let's build more highways, perhaps to a fault in a lot of cases. But it's the almost inevitable outcome, as I mentioned, the post-war boom of babies, boom of automobiles, boom in confidence that America could do all these things. And also, it was a time of booming and urban renewal. whereas an ocean was, let's get rid of the old, put in the new, no matter what. A lot of improvements were made without looking at all the collateral damage on the side. But ultimately, the nation's commerce, vacationing families, people in commuting around town are helped to get places faster by the interstate system. In a way, it's sort of like the internet. The internet does so much good and provides us so much information, and yet the downside is maybe the atomization of our society. So which is better?
You know, Monroe just mentioned that he used to travel through small towns stopping at the stoplights, waiting for pedestrians. But part of that is that the roads went through the downtowns and not around the edges of the towns. And Charlie Nemers from the Transportation Infrastructure Center at Mizzou, you mentioned earlier that where the highway goes through these small towns, you'll see restaurants, often fast food restaurants, pop up, motels, things like that. But what about the downtowns? I mean, the way that I-70 passes through the edges of these towns, what's grown up around them is fairly identical from city to city. I mean, town to town, I guess I should say. And so it makes I-70 kind of makes all of the towns you pass through look a little bit the same. Can you talk to me about how and why it is that I-70 passes through towns the way it does?
Well, I think the biggest role is that we wanted to improve the safety of the traveling public and the running business traffic and through traffic and freight traffic through the hearts of all these little towns was really had a safety impacts that were dramatic. Moving the through traffic out of the downtowns really helped in a lot of ways, but it was a two-edged sword. Much like Monroe said, there was good parts of it and bad parts of it. You got all that through traffic bypassing the city. Well, then entrepreneurs said, well, let's move our businesses out closer to the highway so we can attract business. I know in my family, when we travel, you know, certainly the restaurants, fast foods along the interstate, we know we get a clean rest area. We know that it's a quality of food is very consistent. But most oftentimes we'll pull off and go into the little towns and eat at Glenn's Cafe or at, you know, PT restaurant or something like this just to have the sense of local food. I mean, that's how I discovered lobster rolls, for goodness sake. So there's lots of good things that you can come across when you go into the little towns. But I think it's more of a choice now. If we really want to get to Kansas City for a Royals game, well, I need a hamburger. It's pretty convenient just to grab one right off the freeway. So there's good parts and bad parts. But I think we have to also consider the safety aspects of the interstate and how it made transportation safety really significant.
Well, we're going to get back to that whole, you know, getting off the highway idea when you're traveling very shortly. But I want to play a clip. This is what someone in Oak Grove, Missouri, told one of our reporters, Frank Morris, back in 2006 when he was doing a story on the 50th anniversary of the interstate system. This is a resident's perspective on I-70 where it passes through Oak Grove.
Jesse James was a rank amateur compared to these gas stations up here on the freeway. I wish they'd get them all out of there. Then we'd have a nice little town like it used to be.
But the tens of thousands.
Excuse us for that little blip there. What do you say to someone like that about the way the interstate changed, not just the economy of small towns, but maybe even the culture of small towns?
Well, I think that there's probably people that feel that and share that. I know that, you know, when I was a kid, Sears was drove out of business, a small town little store, and then Walmart's replacing Sears, and now Amazon is replacing Walmart. I think some of those things are just the evolution of our society. There's bad sides and good sides to all of these touches of the interstate down to our civilization. I know that the shape of Kansas City, much like Monroe mentioned, the sprawl into the urban area of the urban areas into both Kansas and Missouri on the south side, especially, you know, 435 now carries more traffic than Interstate 70. And so it's really interesting to see how that has done it. But that doesn't mean there's not really nice neighborhoods and restaurants and industries and businesses and so on that are populating that expanded area as well. So, yes, there's good things and yes, there's bad things. But I think in total, the interstate really has a positive impact on our whole culture.
Let's talk to Daniel in Lawrence, Kansas. Hi, Daniel.
Hello.
Hi. What can you share with us? Do you have a question?
Yeah, I did. I'm a civil engineer and learned about highway design in college, but it was quite a while ago, and there were some urban legends floating around among the people learning about it, and I just wanted to get some confirmation or denial on a couple of things I heard. The first was that the interstate system, it was, you know, proposed by Eisenhower, who was a military man, and principally it was to not just to ship freight across the country and for passenger cars, but also to move military convoys across the country easily. And that part of the design of the interstate system was to act as an emergency runway for aircraft, possibly during wartime, and that certain sections of the system had to be constructed straight and level every few miles so that you could land aircraft on it. Sounds like an urban legend, but it also might have made sense also. And the second one was that before the system was built, they were trying to decide whether to construct the roads out of concrete or asphalt. So they ran tests and determined that asphalt was the most economical pavement system to use over time. But they didn't want to be unfair to the concrete industry. So to be fair to both, they just decided to build the system half out of concrete and half out of asphalt, even though asphalt was cheaper. And I just wanted to see if they had heard of that and if that was true or not.
All right, Charlie, I'm giving these to you.
Okay, I'm really pleased to answer that. Let me attack the first one having to do with the runways. That's entirely urban legend. That's all urban legend. The first part of it with having to moving military equipment, that was one of the driving forces behind it, and that's still true today. There's part of the interstate system that's called the StrawNet, Strategic Highway Network, which identifies certain portions of the interstate are providing access to military bases, to submarine bases and things like this. And so there's certain accesses and strengths of structures that need to accommodate military equipment. So there is some of that that's still there, but the landing of the runways, that's just all legend. The issue of concrete versus asphalt pavement is very interesting. I've been in this business for 50 years, and I don't know that there's any truth to to that story. Both concrete and asphalt have attributes that are attractive to interstate construction. Concrete is more expensive. It's stronger and it lasts longer. Asphalt might be less expensive per ton, but it doesn't last as long under heavy loads of trucks. So it's really sometimes a combination of both. I always thought that probably the perfect interstate pavement was about 10 inches of concrete with 6 inches of asphalt on top. That way you could rejuvenate the surface and relatively easily for skid resistance and things like that. And you had a long, solid base that would last you forever. But that's very expensive to start with. So they both are pretty competitive in their prices. They both, if you look at life cycle costing, percents of trucks that you need to accommodate, sometimes one will come out in favor of the others. There are some states that bid these as options, so contractors, whatever the lowest price is, goes in. So I think it's they're competitive pavements. They both have advantages. But the fact that they were trying to build it 50-50 to keep two industries happy is, I don't think there's any truth to that story.
Let's hear from someone else. We've got Leo on the line from Strawberry Hill. Hi, Leo.
Good morning, Gina. How are you?
Great. How about yourself?
Well, I'm really interested in your conversation this morning.
What can you tell us living there in Strawberry Hill? We were just talking about Strawberry Hill.
Yeah, well, I live right up on the bluffs. If you come across from downtown Kansas City, Missouri, you look up on the hill, you see St. John the Baptist Church, which is a very famous church. And I live immediately adjacent to that building. And I have a clear view, of course, across the Kaw towards downtown. And what everybody that lives in Strawberry Hill knows is about a third of the neighborhood was wiped out in 1957 when the interstate system chose that space to bring the interstate through. And it's still kind of a bone of contention over here. It seems like we're constantly having to fight the KDOT and the interstate system to preserve, you know, what's left of our neighborhood up here. So there's been a lot of good done by the highway system, but we're kind of suffering some of the adverse effects of it up here.
Let's get some response from Monroe, since Monroe knows the local community here in Kansas City pretty well, being a local guy.
I would not argue with a person who's a resident of Strawberry Hill that a big chunk of it had to move away, and that there's arguments because highways, the interstate highways in particular, are like big cities or big machines, sometimes crashing through neighborhoods. And in order to make them as safe and as wide and as easy to access and to egress as possible, there's a downside. Some property has to be bought. People have to move away.
Well, when KCUR Central Standard returns, we'll talk about traveling I-70, and we'll take a look at how Kansas and Missouri are different when you get off the highway. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about I-70. Now we're going to hear from a woman who has driven a stretch of I-70 so much she's written a song about it. Heidi Gluck is originally from Canada. She lives in Lawrence, but before she came to Kansas to start a family, she lived in Indiana. And when she first moved, she really missed her friends and bandmates from back east. You can see where I-70 might figure in here. This is Heidi Gluck's story about her song, Sadness is Psychedelic.
Going east, well, it's usually anticipation for me. I'm usually feeling pretty strong and healthy. I've taken care of stuff at home. I know that I'm going to see friends. I'm just organized in my brain, I think. And then there's the anticipation of the towns like St. Louis. I get the Arch, which is my favorite structure. And then I get to see the cross outside of Effingham, and then I know I'm almost there.
My heart has gone from ripen to relic. This kind of sadness is psychedelic.
Driving back, driving west on 70, it's kind of a blur, honestly, and I think I lose myself, like I get out of my body for a lot of it. I'm usually exhausted. I'm just kind of ready to be back in my bed and see my child, and I don't think I even notice landmarks on the way home.
The St. Louis border across the river, shaping your spine as you remember.
And it was also kind of this come down. You work so hard, you're in the studio, your body hurting, you've kind of poured your heart into something, and then you're alone in the car for a while, and it's just a little empty. You feel a little bit washed out.
Outside Columbia, you stopped to listen. The snow was melting, and the
I felt like I had two lives for a while, and I wasn't making records here on my own. That's the difference, I guess. Now I can go and feel content there. I can know that I'm coming back and I'm going to make some more music here. But there was a stretch where I wasn't making any music in Kansas. I moved here when I had a baby. I didn't really get to meet a lot of people musically. I took like a straight job and didn't play music for 3 years, I think. So once I started playing again and going back to Indiana, that was the only music I got. I guess that was the only like feeling of worth or like artistic worth that I could get. And then I realized that I could have music wherever I am. Like 70 always felt like home, get almost home. And so now it kind of feels that, oh, that's nice. It kind of feels like that both ways. Like when I get to Indiana, that's, I'm almost home. And when I get to Lawrence, I'm almost home.
St. Louis border across the river, shaping your spine as you remember. Nothing can die that's never delivered. So just drive, just drive, just drive, drive.
That was Lawrence bass musician Heidi Gluck talking about Sadness is Psychedelic, the first song she wrote for her new album, Pony Show. This story of a song was produced by KCUR's Suzanne Hogan. So, I-70 is the most obvious way to travel across Kansas and Missouri. So it's a pretty common way to see those states, and we heard about the landmarks that people who travel the states that way are used to seeing. But that's not the only way to travel across Kansas and Missouri. Our next guest knows a lot about that. She wrote a book called Driving Across Missouri. Luann Cadden, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So for you, I mean, what do you think about the way I-70 shapes the view of Missouri in particular?
Fast-paced. When we were researching this book, many people said, oh, why are you writing about an interstate? Why don't you write about the back roads and all those quaint small highways that go through the towns? And we said, well, the whole reason we're writing this book is because there's nothing out there on this, because people drive it. They have to drive it, whether they're a commuter or a traveler. And we want to try to make the interstate more enjoyable for them. So my co-author had written one on Kansas first called Driving Across Kansas. And the reason he wrote that was because we had friends here in Missouri who said, I only drive through Kansas on the way to Colorado at night because there's nothing to see. So that was written because there was nothing to see.
Whereas, yeah, it's kind of a refrain around here, like, oh, driving on I-70 across Kansas, like you're never going to get anywhere.
Yes, exactly. So he says, I'm going to find those stories by mile markers. And so it's not a book about getting off the highway and where you go. It's what you can see on the land and stories you might not know about if you travel it all the time. With Missouri, it was the opposite effect. Missouri is congested, and as you said, the billboards are everywhere. In fact, we thought about calling the book Beyond the Billboards to help people see those stories beyond just the blinders that you have with those billboards. And the stories that we looked for were some of history. Some were natural history, if there was nothing out there. And others were like a modern history, really, the people who live there now. And we hoped that those stories actually would just make the interstate more personal for both the people who travel it and the people who live along the side. In fact, doing this book was nice for those residents who live along I-70. We interviewed quite a few people, like with substantial farms, and they were wonderful to talk to, and they loved talking about their farm, and they were so proud of it. And We were hoping that this was more of a bringing communities together and seeing the good of it.
Visually, how would you compare the view from the highway of Missouri to the view of Missouri when you're just a very short ways away from the interstate?
Okay, from the highway. So oftentimes, and it was interesting listening to her song just now when she said on her way home, she didn't really notice anything. And that's how a lot of people, I think, we just get used to that. We just drive and we look straight ahead and everything is the same. But that view from the highway, if you take that time and look out, like what we noticed, we had to drive it many, many times in writing this book to find the best things, the things people might notice or might not notice. From the highway, we saw things like cemeteries way in the distance that you would never notice if you were just looking straight ahead. And we found histories of Civil War soldiers who were buried there and of some of the Civil War battles that took place here in Missouri that did shape our state. We looked at agriculture different. I grew up in the city. I'm not a rural girl, and I learned quite a bit about agriculture and learned how to appreciate so much of it and the hardworking people who live along the side. Barns are beautiful. Some people love barns, and you see these gorgeous structures that have endured weather and time, and we have stories about those, and we have stories about one barn in particular, we thought it was a barn, and it ended up being a very historic site. So surprises. And I think when you look off the interstate with new eyes in a new way, that you can find some of these stories that will make that drive more enjoyable and more personal for you.
This is, I mean, you're talking about kind of the opposite of a roadside attraction that's like built to grab your attention from the highway. But I've heard that that some of the roadside attractions have been closing in recent years. There was the Prairie Dog place off of I-70, and there was the Elvis is Alive Museum. Those were some landmarks from my childhood drives along I-70 in Missouri. And talk to me about the difference between a roadside attraction and the kinds of places you're talking about.
Definitely. And as you say, some of these closed over time. We didn't want to write about some businesses, but we didn't want to write about things that could come and go. We wanted more of a history. So the things we wrote about, for example, here's one with the barn. It looked, as you're driving down the interstate, right next off the interstate, it's the back of a white building that looks like a barn. We pulled off the interstate to see it, and it actually was the chapel of the Danville Female Academy in the 1800s and during the 1860s. And it remained, it was the only remaining structure from this entire quad where the school was, after some Southern sympathizers came through looking for Union soldiers. And they told the girls, we need the key to your chapel. We need to come in and look and see if there's Union soldiers. And the girls were a bit frightened, and we talked to the local people about their story, and they said that the girls used a white petticoat in order as a sign of truce to please leave them alone. And there were multiple stories we heard which were wonderful. One was they hung their petticoat above the front door. Another one is all the girls waved their petticoats out the windows and said, oh, we love you Southern boys. And either way, they're a white, we know at least one white petticoat saved the school from being burnt down. And we thought, if you were just driving across the interstate and you just saw the back of this white barn, it looks like just an abandoned white barn. But we're noticing some of those little sights that you wouldn't otherwise notice, like you said, not like a roadside attraction.
Charlie Nemers, can you talk to me a little bit about why the Missouri you see when you get off of I-70 would be so different from the Missouri you see from I-70?
Well, I think that there's both commonalities and difference. Once you get off of I-70, depending on the eastern half of I-70, closer to St. Louis, the terrain is a little hillier. As you get west of closer to Kansas City, the terrain flattens out a little bit. But I think that most of the off of I-70 is agricultural, and it's different kinds of agriculture. There might be corn and beans and parts of it, but it's also timber, recreational activities that are centered on it. You know, it crosses over the Missouri two different times, and then it parallels the Missouri quite a bit of the way, especially in the Kansas City area. So some of that major geographic or geologic formations contributes as well. I know that some of the areas south of the interstate where you get into the karst formations with caves and rocks form a different sort of environment when you get just a few miles off the interstate. So I think that I agree with Lou Ann that if you jump off the interstate and drive just a little bit, you can find lots of really interesting culture, but it's still heavily agricultural based.
What can you tell us about the future of I-70?
Well, I think that, I listened to the speech last night by President Trump, and he's talking about infrastructure growth and whatever. And I know that central to anything that going to go happen in Missouri is going to be widening of I-70 or improving its service, because it's so, like we said, it's so old that it's going to have to be widened and strengthened. And I think probably one way or another in the next few years we'll see a whole new strengthening and widening of Interstate 70 across Missouri. I sure hope that happens, because it's got to improve the safety and the service for this key artery.
Well, our time is up for this conversation about I-70. Charlie Nemers, thank you so much.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Lou Ann Cadden, author of Driving Across Missouri, thank you too.
Thank you, Gina.
Monroe Dodd, we will see you again for another history show very soon, I'm
always
sure.
Always a pleasure, Gina.
Tomorrow, we have a lot to share with you, including a profile of your Morning Edition host, Michael Byers. He'll be part of a storytelling event at Knuckleheads next Thursday night. The theme is Up All Night, so you can imagine that a guy who wakes up at like 3 a.m. or something would have a story to tell about that. Tune in tomorrow for a little taste of what's in store. You can listen back to this show or any of the shows you've heard on Central Standard at kcur.org/centralstandard. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Special thanks today to Frank Morris. Caitlin Troutman is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.